Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
A date which will live in infamy.
Tune in to KBOO on election night, Tuesday, November 8th at 6 p.m. for our live midterm election coverage. We'll have coverage that counts from local, county, state, and national races. Our anchors will be with you while the vote tallies come in, and we'll also feature analysis from your favorite KBOO hosts. That's KBOO's live midterm election coverage starting at 6 p.m. on Tuesday, November 8th. Don't miss it.
KBOO radio station is located in Portland, Oregon, in Multnomah County. We honor the indigenous people whose traditional and ancestral homelands we stand on, the Multnomah, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Tumwater, Watlala bands of the Chinook, the Tualatin, Kalapuya, and many other indigenous nations of the Willamette and Columbia River regions. It is important to acknowledge the ancestors of this land and to recognize that we are here because of the sacrifices forced upon them. In remembering these communities, we honor their legacy, their lives, and their descendants with the forming of relationship to each other and the living world. We establish and support harmony within ourselves and set the stage for praxis.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The following program is a rebroadcast. For all of KBOO's archived audio, please visit our website at kboo.fm.
Welcome to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational discussion about race with independent journalists from the Pacific Northwest. From Grassroot News Northwest, I'm your host and moderator, Lenita Duke.
I'm Althea Billings. I'm the news director here at KBOO.
I'm Cecil Prescott. I'm a talk show host.
I am Professor Johnson, political commentator from Houston, Texas.
Hello, this is Nia Gray, the host of The Faith Report, where faith and social justice meet.
Come on.
Let's talk about race. Baby, let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that make me. Let's talk about
race. Welcome to another edition of Let's Talk About Race. Today, we are going to deconstruct and explain critical race theory with the voices of our panel, as well as the voice of the late Dr. Derrick Bell. Now, Dr. Bell was part of a group of legal scholars and experts who developed the concept of critical race theory. Racism and white supremacy are regular, commonplace aspects of life in America. Now, critical race theory gives us the vocabulary to understand how our power structures in America operate and why there continues to be disparities in education, health, wealth, and power. And this challenges our ideas of equality and opportunity. Critical race theory is an academic framework centering on the idea that racism is systemic and not just demonstrated by individual people with prejudices. Critical race theory holds that racial inequality is woven into the legal system that negatively affects people of color in schools, doctor offices, and countless other parts of life. Dr. Derek Bell said that critical race theory aims to shift focus away from individual people's bad actions and toward how systems uphold racial disparities. Now, there's a big controversy right now going on in America. Curriculum designed to address systemic racism seeks to make classrooms more equitable, and other school districts across the country are trying to institute anti-bias training for teachers that requires history lessons that includes the experiences of marginalized people. Now, conservative politicians have pushed back against these attempts to talk about race more often, and critics say that teachers are trying to rewrite history and should not consider race when interacting with students. And this is the controversy. Critical race theory.
If you want to address inequality, you have to have data. In order to have data, you have to pay attention to where people from different segments of society are situated. You have to be able to look at the relationships between race and health outcomes, race and class, race and educational outcomes, right? And so if you are colorblind, and there we have examples in other nations, Germany might be an example, where if you don't actually keep track of race, you have no mechanisms for addressing racial injustice. That is absolutely untenable in this country that has been organized from the outset around racial inequality. So it's a really, it's a problematic form of legal interpretation. But if we go a step further, if we can't even talk about it in schools, right, it actually has the potential to diminish our young people's ability to be sort of active civic participants, to understand the world they occupy and hopefully build a better society.
This is Dr. Derek Bell.
If we face up to the reality of racism and the role it plays in the society, that it's not simply an aberration, that it's a necessary stabilizing influence in a society like ours, that doesn't mean that we give up. It means that we are able to face the real problems, the real enemy, if you will, and to fashion tactics and strategies that are likely to be more effective. Not guaranteed, not likely even, to bring about the kind of error we thought about when we sang We Shall Overcome, but likely to be a more meaningful, lead to more meaningful endeavor than we're now engaged in.
Now today, we are also joined in this discussion on critical race theory with Mary Lee. Mary Lee is the director of the Multnomah Idea Lab, a think tank in Portland, Oregon.
I think most specifically, the right is very strong on this right now for a couple of reasons. One is that critical race theory speaks to systemic and structural oppression, and in the case of racism, white supremacy and white privilege. And that's a very uncomfortable notion for the right to engage with. They are much more comfortable to be at an individual level and in that stance of, oh, they're individuals and I never enslaved anyone and I never did that and the other thing, can comfortably say it's in the past, it has nothing to do with me, and thus I bear no responsibility for it, nor for white privilege, I don't believe it exists, right? So I think this crux of, are you thinking about it individually or are you thinking about it systemically and structurally, is one of the reasons the right pushes against this.
A recent race forum in the Rockwood School District sparked a hot debate. How should or shouldn't we talk about race in schools? The term critical race theory has gotten a lot of attention recently.
Some Missouri lawmakers have even taken steps to ban it.
What is critical race theory? Parents at this forum on race and curriculum in the Rockwood School District are not the only ones fired up about it.
I did not use the word racist.
Scholars
pillars of critical race theory define it as recognizing race as a social construct, but one that's been deeply embedded in American institutions throughout history. They say you can see implications of that today.
White privilege is real. It is so real.
Like in the criminal justice system or even demographics of communities, advocates say CRT urges people to grapple with systemic racism, to work toward understanding and fairness.
What are the biases that could exist in the system so that we can actually create that platform and create the equity that we all long for?
But opponents have said CRT perpetuates racism.
It's basically white shaming, and that's basically a racist viewpoint.
Saying it pushes the idea that white people are inherently racist and people of color inherently oppressed.
We can do a lot of good for the nation from here, but not if we're continually divided by race and or gender. Let's look at ourselves as equal. I think that's what Martin Luther King Jr. was looking for.
Some Missouri lawmakers are pushing to ban CRT in schools. They say it can make
children
feel bad.
To me, this is child abuse.
Past several years, there have been many attempts to fundamentally change our traditions and our rich history.
A history that has been largely written by white people.
All we want is just a little acknowledgement.
America can be a great country, and while also being a flawed country, and that it is okay to address those flaws, to bring attention to it, and in some cases, rewrite a more accurate version of history.
Defining race-related terms like CRT is one thing, having the difficult conversations is another.
I think a less, perhaps, I don't know what the right word is, it's not innocent, innocuous is, you know, this country's economic and social systems were founded on the enslavement of Black folks and the genocide of Indigenous peoples. However, our economy still functions on the premise of anti-Blackness and white supremacy and white privilege, right? And there's a true cash value to that white privilege. Scott Nakagawa talks about anti-Blackness as the fulcrum to white privilege as the lever, and the recognizing of cash value of white privilege. And, you know, he gives this example about, you know, it was possible to sue people and receive a cash settlement if you were accused of being Black. You would never hear of someone suing another person for accusing them to be white, because that was what people wanted to be. There was no damage to be accused of being white. There was only monetary and societal value to being accused of, you know, quote on being white. And I think when an individual's economic status or a class of people, AKA white folks, economic status is challenged or perceived to be challenged by the actual presence of people of color with identity and advocacy and self-determination, people will fight back with everything they got. And I think there's a germ of understanding there about Trumpism and that whole relationship to that dynamic. And in fact, in the way in which the right is responding to critical race theory, tying to this economic perspective, actually proves the point that it exists. Because if it didn't exist, it wouldn't matter to them, right? If it was not challenging their individual perception, if it was not challenging or being perceived to challenge by the fact that there were, you know, in this case, free Black folks who understand what happened here structurally and what is our economy today, you wouldn't be fighting it. And the very basics, the basis that people are fighting it says there's a point there, and that point is tied to money and economy. So I think that's a couple of reasons why the right is fighting it now. You know, from my perspective, I feel like folks can't have it both ways. If the right wants to take us down this path of venerating the past and what the founding fathers intended, then they all, and how that now impacts us today, then they also have to, if they're not being disingenuous, understand and include the function and the reality of structural racism as a part of that past that still continues to impact today. You can't pick and choose. If that's your stance on, you know, what part of the past you want to honor and center as the reality for today, and what you, you know, conveniently would like to not acknowledge and center as the meaningful today, I think the other two things I would share is what's interesting to me is this term, critical race theory, as well as intersectionality, it came out of the legal profession and the efforts of many, many people of color to seek redress from the very system that was organized and codifying the oppression. And again, this impact of what does it mean to seek redress in the system that was organized explicitly to oppress people of color and lift up white supremacy. And this interesting thing that happens when legal analysis or strategy becomes a part of the current, you know, social language, and how that does or doesn't play out in the community. And the second thing that I want to raise up when we think about critical race theory is this false narrative, and we've talked about this before, of Asian Americans and Black and African Americans being at odds. That's a lie. It's a false narrative. There were Asian folks who were in with the other Derrick Bell and Kimberly Crenshaw, Mari Matsuda, and other Asian activists and attorneys and legal minds who were at the formation of the constructs of critical race theory, of intersectionality, supporting it, being a part of the work to develop it. And that is true today. And it's another place where I think this opportunity to call out this false narrative, these lies about when Asians and African Americans do or don't get together. This is another place where that is happening. And to the extent there are members of the Asian community who are trying to portray that critical race theory is somehow discriminatory to Asian Americans, because there is certainly that that action that's happening, there are equally Asian American and Pacific Islander activists and legal minds overtly speaking against and speaking to the ignorance of those who are purporting to have this perspective, while also inviting them in to get into it with, you know, get into it with their people and get into it with Black folks to try to understand what's going on here in a way that is not separatist, is not at odds. And I think that's a real, for me, that's one of the really important concepts of critical race theory right now. And, you know, then circling back to your question, that's what's dangerous to the right and to the structure, is if people of color get together and we share some commonality and we share some understanding and we begin to use their own tools, the legal system, to try to right the wrongs and lift up the oppression and the white supremacy culture that exists all around us, that's when you're messing with folks, and that's where they're gonna have some energy pushing back, and I think that's part of what we're seeing right now.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational journalistic roundtable focusing on the issue of race. From Grassroot News, I'm your host and moderator, Lanita Duke.
I'm Althea Billings. I'm the news director here at KBOO.
I'm Cecil Prescott. I'm a talk show host.
I am Professor Johnson, political commentator from Houston, Texas.
Hello, this is Nia Gray, the host of The Faith Report, where faith and social justice meet.
Come on.
Let's talk about race. Race. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all of the things and the bad things that make me. Let's talk about
race. Race. Race.
Governor Brian Kemp takes action to keep the critical race theory out of Georgia classrooms. In short, it's an academic concept exploring racism, examining what it derives from and where it's embedded in society.
The theory is quickly becoming a politically divisive topic, with leaders from nearly a dozen states politically opposing proposals to teach it in schools.
Yeah, it was nothing short of explosive. This meeting here in Cherokee County included parents yelling at each other, parents yelling at school board members. Ultimately, the district voted to ban critical race theory in all county classrooms.
To teach that one group is either better or worse than, or victimized by, or is the victimizer, that is the epitome of teaching racism.
A packed room,
mostly in favor of a district ban on critical race theory in the 1619 Project. Both show how slavery, race, and status all intersect, creating equity gaps from neighborhoods to schools to the legal systems.
I don't feel comfortable with them being told that they're a victim because of my skin color, and they're a privileged racist because of my husband's skin color.
For nearly an hour, parents lashed out at the board, saying it's time for, quote, conservative Georgia to stand up.
We have people in our community and in our world who don't want to acknowledge the fact that racism exists.
This is a group of people that clearly don't understand what's at risk here.
Critics argue
white privilege didn't do any of it.
By highlighting racial differences, there's a further division among kids they claim are too young to consider skin color. But it's that very notion which has supporters saying the teaching is severely needed, a means to foster critical thinking and diversity.
It's disheartening, it's embarrassing, and it really just highlights two Americas.
Now, the district said they would still be including a social and emotional learning initiative, or SEL. They claim that would focus on equity and inclusion. And in response to that announcement, it left this crowd in a frustrated uproar.
The racial reckoning that we are in the midst of, and the COVID pandemic, you know, exposing cracks in the status quo and the systems as they are, I think it has prompted some to look for a framework to explain those types of things and to explain the shortcomings that have taken center stage. And critical race theory is one way to do that. It's maybe not by name, but that is kind of an overarching theme. But in terms of what the backlash is to that, a broad understanding of white supremacy, of government, and of capitalism, and how those intertwine and are in fact detrimental to most everyday people. Broad understanding of that threatens the control that the GOP, that conservatives have over American culture and politics. Conservative political values, conservative social values are actually incredibly predominant in this country. The US is a very conservative nation in a variety of different frames. And in order to preserve itself, however, conservative values must present themselves as being constantly under attack. And so, you know, as we've kind of mentioned here, that some of it is a bit vague. What does it truly mean? Are we talking in the same terms? Things like critical race theory or cancel culture, these are sorts of things that I've seen that become a conservative talking point because they sound a little bit scary rather than what are they actually grounded in? What does it actually mean? But they have a scary enough name that conservatives can use it to threaten their base. And it's not about critical thinking as to whether or not this academic framework has value in, you know, lower levels of education than, as Cecil mentioned, grad school. I remember when I started ninth grade, the first thing we ever had to do in history class was read this article and write an essay explaining why the study of history is important. And most everybody kind of touched on those same points, right? That history informs the present, and if we don't know it, we may end up being doomed to repeat it. And I'll say, even in this past year, just, you know, being on the internet and all of these different things, there's so many aspects of American history that I've learned about not in an academic setting. And thinking about how life would have been different for me or for peers if I being introduced to these sorts of things earlier on is very interesting. But I think one of the things that came up for me in thinking about, you know, how should the history of the United States and specifically slavery be taught in schools was just about how twisted the history became after the Civil War, and that it wasn't, you know, the classic idiom that the history was written by the victor. It was actually written by the loser. The Confederates wrote the history of the American Civil War that is widely accepted in classrooms across the United States.
The root cause of the Civil War is clear.
What caused the Civil War was
slavery.
The main cause and why the South decided to secede was for slavery.
But according to a report from the Southern Poverty Law Center, only 8% of high school seniors surveyed could name slavery as the root cause of the Civil War. So why do our history textbooks get it so wrong?
Textbooks are written and edited for states.
This is Antoinette Waters, a history teacher at Wakefield High School in Arlington, Virginia, who says the state
has the final say in what is in a textbook.
Which is how you end up with textbooks like this 1993 textbook from Alabama, which opens its brief section on slavery with this: people of all races have been slaves. And then goes on to teach children that the main difference between the North and the South leading up to the Civil War wasn't slavery, but rather a fight between the independent-minded Southern states and an overbearing federal government, or as the textbooks put it, states' rights.
When you say states' rights, I always like to answer, a state's rights to do what?
It's the state's rights to do what? To have slavery.
Textbooks like these are approved at the state level. But anyone, regardless of their accreditation, education, or agenda, is free to write or edit a school history textbook.
And sometimes when you go down the list of editors, some of them may not be historians. It could be a PTA mom. It could be a minister.
And because anyone can edit the contents of a history textbook,
you have to think of what perspective do they want to be told.
Around the start of the Reconstruction era, some white Southerners wanted to tell a whitewashed perspective of Civil War history. They started organizations dedicated to memorializing Confederate soldiers, erected statues to Confederate generals, and perhaps most troublingly, they established commissions dedicated to overseeing and recommending textbooks for children, which is why
slavery in our classrooms was taught as being this benign institution. Paternalistic slave owners enslaved people as loving members of the white family. And of course, African Americans and African American scholars had always said, this makes no damn sense.
This is Hassan Kwame Jeffries, an associate professor of African American history at Ohio State University.
We really don't begin to see a change in the way slavery is taught in America's classrooms until the Civil Rights era, where African Americans are more thoroughly integrated into the decision-making in the classroom.
But progress was slow. For some states, those changes to their textbooks are only occurring today, a half century later. In fact, this is the first year that public school students in Texas will be required to learn that slavery was the central cause of the Civil War. The inaccuracies in children's textbooks are important to address because children grow up to be adults who say things like,
the lack of an ability to compromise led to the Civil War.
In order to ensure her students aren't taking in an agenda-driven view of history, Antoinette has basically tossed textbooks altogether.
How do I say what the facts are? I actually use primary source documents. You can't argue with the document. And I take out the very first state to secede's paper. And I read them. The cause of the Civil War 100% was enslavement.
Alexander Stevens, Vice President of the Confederacy, says clearly, slavery is the cornerstone of the Confederacy.
Whether it be the economics of enslavement, the expansion of enslavement.
Confederates themselves are clear that slavery is the central cause of secession and the glue that is binding the states of the Confederacy. We don't have to make up words. We can use the own words of people in the time that they are living.
Yet even now, when most American textbooks include slavery as the cause of the Civil War, the problem isn't what's included in the textbooks, but
what's left out that makes these textbooks problematic.
For example, there's
almost no discussion of the fact that slavery existed in the North.
Or that you could be opposed to the institution of slavery
and still believe in white supremacy. That is fundamental. If you do not get that, if you only get the anti-slavery side, if you only get the abolition side, and you drop the belief in white supremacy, then you wind up with a mistaken notion that racism is something that is confined solely to the South. By avoiding these hard topics of slavery and teaching it accurately, what we are doing is avoiding turning the camera back on ourselves and explaining why do we have the problems that we have today.
You will not replace us!
Progress is so slow. Change is so constant here, but progress is such a slow process.
If you can't accurately understand the past, the ways in which society has been built and constructed economically, politically, and socially, then you cannot make sense of the present. And if you can't make sense of the present, how on earth are you expected to solve the problems that are plaguing us today and will continue to plague us in the future.
I think it's important for our kids to know the truth because they have to know where we've come from. But then they also have to understand the beautiful journey of overcoming, how you can be enslaved and start with nothing and become president of the United States of America.
And it was the end of the Reconstruction era that left this work that was not done, right? There were no tribunals, there was no permanent punishment for those who defected against the Union and for those who were defending with their life their ability to enslave other people. And there was no reckoning. The reckoning at that time was not fully done. And that's why these things still persist. And I think whether it's critical race theory or something by another name, taking that true look at what the history is, I think is absolutely instrumental in building minds, in building a real, you know, you can go into the whole conversation around public school and why is it worth educating anyone anyways. People need to know their history so that they can make up their own mind, so that they can become informed citizens. These are things that they are currently deprived of, and that there are material impacts of the entire history of institutionalized racism in the United States that we have the power to rectify. We are the richest country in the world. These are not abstract ideas. It's not a philosophical question. So I think that it needs to be tackled in a lower grade, that it shouldn't just be a situation where if you are lucky enough to go to college, you have the opportunity to think critically about these things.
If you are just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational journalistic roundtable focusing on the issue of race. From Grassroots News, I'm your host and moderator, Lanita Duke.
I'm Althea Billings. I'm the news director here at KBOO.
I'm Cecil Prescott. I'm a talk show host.
I am Professor Johnson, political commentator from Houston, Texas.
Hello, this is Nia Gray, the host of The Faith Report, where faith and social justice meet.
So Cecil, do you think that the opposition against the critical race theory is just another backlash that's going on in America right now?
I think it is a convenient tool that many on the right are using, because it is easy setting up a straw dog. And what it involves, I think, is another means or way in which to attack those who are critiquing and those who are questioning our laws. And it's important to remember that this so-called critical race theory is primarily an academic movement that is examined in law schools and graduate schools that talk about the intersection of laws and the issues of race and the challenge to mainstream approaches to racial justice. And so much of the pushback is, I would say, based on straw dogs. So for fact that people are outlawing teaching of critical race theory, well, it isn't taught in elementary school or high school, and maybe not even in college. It's something that grad students talk about and law school students talk about. So yes, I think it's another straw dog that people are using to critique those who would have a critical examination of our society. And, you know, I think it's also important to remember, you know, the origins of critical race theories. People such as the law professor Derrick Bell, who taught about examining from the bottom up. So many people are talking about it, and so few people have any idea of what it is.
That's a wonderful phrase to examine critical race theory.
So many people are talking about it. No one really knows what it is. Let's bring in Professor Johnson. Professor Johnson, you're a college professor. What's your take on critical race theory, and why is there such a backlash against it?
My definition of what critical race theory is attempting to do is to correct the history that we have been taught and to address the fact that our history has been written about and talked to us from a point of view that is not that of African Americans, for one thing. And secondly, we don't really teach the history of race, specifically slavery, in this country. And the 1619 Project, which was quite a powerful effort by Nicole Hannah Jones, who wrote for the New York Times. She actually won a Pulitzer Prize for her contribution to the 1619 Project. And that project developed tools for schools to use to teach a more accurate account of history, specifically of slavery and the treatment of Black people historically in this country. What I've seen as that's come about as a backlash is some of it just seems misdirection, to move the argument or to twist the argument into something else other than what the intention of this critical race theory and the introduction into education than it is. So some of the opposition has been disagreements on what was actually the first date that slavery was introduced into the country, where 1619 was intended or was based on 400 years of slavery. That's when this whole project got started. But a lot of historians are saying, well, you know, in America, before the United States, slaves were brought here. One of the other objections is that it's specifically addressing slavery in the United States when, in fact, there's been slavery all over the world. So that's another, you know, another view is that the subject should be addressed more broadly. And there are even some African American professors who are also agreeing that the history of slavery in this country began before 1619. It may have even began with Christopher Columbus. Now, they've also made arguments that by addressing this change in how we educate people around, especially in academic situations, is putting a racial lens on history. And that in itself is racist. So that's been some of the other arguments. But I would just say, my thought is that the facts are the facts. And history tends to, whether it's the history of Western civilization or the history of the United States, broadly, these books have been written from a Western point of view. And what the 1619 Project intended to do was to give a point of view from the people that experienced it. And I think that's important.
This is Dr. Derek Bell.
The piece that I wrote at the beginning of Faces at the Bottom of the Well talks about Black people are the faces at the bottom of the societal well. Whites, many of whom occupy a level only slightly above the Blacks, reach down and are mesmerized. Some reach out and try to pull us up. They know that unless they help us up, they won't be able to move to the different level. But rather than look up at the top to see who it is that's keeping us both down, they remain fixated on us and determine that they will stay where they are if it means we can stay down further below. Well, there's something of that, and it is encouraged by varying groups at the top, because it takes the heat off them. That's George Bush, isn't it? We're coming up to another election, but last time Bush, who came into power on Reagan's policies, where there had been a greater growth in the disparity between the upper class and the rest of us, almost in the history of the country, didn't talk about that at all. He talked about waving the flag and talked about the Willie Horton. He moved the focus away from where the problems really are and focused them in one way or another, somewhat more subtly maybe than Reagan, some would say not so much more subtly, on race. But and it works. It works every time.
You seem to be saying that it works every time, not in terms necessarily of Reagan or of Bush or of X or Y or of Z, but in terms of whites and blacks in America.
Oh, sure. The individuals change over time, but the willingness to use race as a detour, as a change of focus away from where the real issues are, has been. That's how slavery got started. Those able to afford slaves were able to convince those whites who could not afford slaves that somehow, even though the presence of slaves meant that the rest of those whites were always going to be in a disadvantaged economic position, that they needed to stay together to avoid, you know, to fight off the slave revolts and all the rest. And we have the same thing today with affirmative action and some of those policies, don't we?
Nia Gray, why was it important to have the panel discuss this issue?
I feel like it was important for the panel to discuss the issue, as I'm sure that our panel, as well as our listeners, has seen critical race theory come up in news articles as politicians, GOP politicians, local, municipal entities, as well as public and private schools have articles that the parents are up in arms. I've seen articles that I've read as early as today where white parents are calling critical race theory child abuse. They're calling it an anti-American form of child abuse. It makes white kids feel bad about themselves. And there's a lot of local governments and efforts to try to ban critical race theory or any type of sort of anti-racism curriculum in local education. And what's funny is in Christian circles, we've seen this happen over the last few years with the Baptist church rejecting critical race theory in the church. And it's interesting because it's the same narrative. The church says that woke church and these terms like critical race theory have been politicized. So some of their dog whistles, and they're not even dog whistles, they're just straight up barking, that they love to call it Marxist and a Marxist ideology that's a threat to the American way of life. It's also divisive. And when my church told me it was divisive, I said, look around, we're already divided in this all white sort of congregation. So this isn't what's dividing us. This is just a distraction. So we're seeing the same sort of white nationalist playbook play out in secular in education. And then also what we've seen, you know, in the church. Also, we've talked in the past about QAnon. And it's interesting because there's these sort of GOP QAnon supported conspiracy theories that are also have sort of a Christian element to them as well about slavery, trying to rewrite slavery, ignoring the brutality of slavery, even going far enough to say that slavery began in the Bible. So I guess it's okay. In the Bible, there are stories of slaves who love their slave masters. So apparently, as Americans, with the brutality of slavery, we're okay. Because, you know, they had slaves in the Bible. They put these anti-Christian and anti-American spins, you know, on woke church and on critical race theory. And I just want to say one thing, and don't send your bad email or your hateful email to Let's Talk About Race. You can send it directly to me because this is just Nia's opinion. But I felt very disappointed in Vice President Harris. When we have these conversations, the purpose of this show is to be an intersection of race, healthcare, education, politics. America is a racist nation with systemic racism and individual racism in its DNA all the way down to the nucleus. So I personally don't care what VP Harris says. I disagree. America is a racist nation. And until we can admit that, either through this education or other ways, we're not going to make any progress. So send your hate mail to me.
This is Dr. Derek Bell.
My experience, current events as we read them, all point to one conclusion about racism in this society. And that, Mr. Hefner, is that it is permanent. That it is an essential. It is not an aberration. It is not what most of us believed it was 30, 40 years ago. A pimple on an otherwise beautiful complexion of America as a place of freedom and equality for all. We all believed that at one time. That was the Gunnar Myrdal report, the huge study of racial discrimination in the 40s. And we all accepted that. As a litigator, I acted on that belief. And I think, though, that even though it means tearing down in a way much of what I've done, much of what others have done, that we have to, on the tatters of what we thought would be a wonderful edifice, on in the ruins, we have to see what there is to be seen. And that leads me to that conclusion.
It's not just critical race theory or the history of Native Americans or the history of slavery, although Rick Santorum put his foot in his mouth when he said in his speech that basically America was created from a blank slate, as if there wasn't already a race of people here, a culture already, that Americans came in and destroyed and then brought in another race of people to create wealth on the backs of African slaves. But honestly, it's a lack of history. It really amazes me, and even within my own church, the people who consider themselves Christians are completely historically illiterate. Like, they just accept whatever they told you in the third grade and have continued to make decisions in their life. So for example, you know, there are a lot of Christians who are anti-immigrant, you know, send those Central American immigrants back where they are, don't let them in, not realizing, knowing, or even have the interest to go in and read and do a little bit of research, that it was America's involvement in Central America since the 1940s. I'm not gonna say it's all America's fault, but the puppet leaders, the financial interests, the Iran-Contra scandal. I mean, there's so many crises that were contributed to by the quote unquote American way of life, the things that Americans want, our colonization, just our selfishness, our capitalism, what we need to get in from these people and from their lands. So that's what we're experiencing now, but nobody wants to talk about that. They just want to criticize the immigrants that are coming over, and you can't come here because of whatever reason, not realizing that they're trying to escape these situations that we helped create, and we also didn't go in to protect these citizens from some of these situations. You know, all the things that happened after World War II. And so there's so many people here who are just ignorant of history in general. So I think that until people want to look back, just like Professor Johnson said, until we look back and look at these choices and also look at the parallels, there's so many things that are happening now that when I read history, I go, oh no, not again. I mean, here we go again with some of these same issues, this same white nationalism, the same American nationalism that we were experiencing in, you know, World War II, that kept us from actually getting involved in the war until we had some skin in the game, when we knew what was happening, that we dropped the bomb on Hiroshima and we knew that they were going to, you know, raise the white flag and didn't even get anything that we wanted out of that agreement. I mean, so it's really disheartening. As you can see, it's really angering. And so until we want to explore and learn history, I think that's like the first step. in this, and just stop listening to this disinformation and go and try to find the information yourself. Don't just take American history from your QAnon friends on Facebook. Go and do some due diligence and study. So that's my two cents.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational journalistic roundtable focusing on the issue of race. From Grassroots News, I'm your host and moderator, Lanita Duke.
I'm Althea Billings. I'm the news director here at KBOO.
I'm Cecil Prescott. I'm a talk show host.
I am Professor Johnson, political commentator from Houston, Texas.
Hello, this is Nia Gray, the host of The Faith Report, where faith and social justice meet.
Well, Cecil, how can we go about teaching slavery and how indigenous people got their land stolen, the true history of America, without such a backlash? I know it's uncomfortable, but it sure as heck is uncomfortable for us and our ancestors.
Indeed. I think what we are seeing is a desire to create and imagine history of the United States.
Listen to how this textbook describes slavery.
The master often had a barbecue or a picnic for his slaves. Then they had a great frolic. Even while working in the cotton fields, they sang songs. The beat of the music and the richness of their voices made work seem light.
Yikes, that's from History of Georgia, a textbook published in 1954 that was taught across junior high schools in Georgia for decades. That sort of language is part of an intellectual movement called the Lost Cause, a distorted version of American Civil War history that's been prevalent in the South for a long time. It took shape soon after the defeat of the Confederate States in the war, when Southern historians like Edward Pollard and former Confederate General Jubal Early started preserving the South's perspective through their writings. They framed the Confederate cause as a heroic defense of the Southern way of life against the overwhelming forces in the North. That narrative has a few basic tenets: the glorification of Confederate soldiers who died for a cause they believed in, the belief that slavery was a benevolent institution, and maybe most importantly, that slavery was not the root cause of the war. The Lost Cause is one of the most notoriously effective efforts to rewrite history, and it was done by the losing side. So how did it become so deeply rooted in Southern memory? Blame the United Daughters of the Confederacy. The UDC was founded in Nashville in 1894 to preserve Confederate culture for generations to come. The women who made up the group descended from elite antebellum families, and they used their social and political clout to spread the pro-Southern version of the war as real history. You've probably seen their efforts to honor the Confederacy, but maybe you didn't know it was the UDC. They're the ones who covered the Southern landscape with memorials for Confederate leaders and soldiers. They used their fundraising and lobbying skills to pressure local governments into erecting monuments in prominent public spaces like courthouses and state capitals.
Installed here next to the state capitol by the United Daughters of the Confederacy.
The United Daughters of the Confederacy donated this memorial to the city back in the 30s.
They put them along roadsides and in parks. Any place that was remotely relevant to the Confederacy was memorialized. By the early 20th century, the UDC had 100,000 members and chapters spread all over the country, but mostly in former Confederate states. And there's a reason they grew so quickly during that time.
So we're talking about roughly 3 decades after the end of the war, and the Confederate veterans themselves are beginning to die off. So there is this push to find ways to commemorate it, because the big challenge by 1900 was there's a new generation of white Southerners being born, and they never experienced the war years.
That push is visible. Most of the Confederate monuments were erected during the UDC's height of influence.
There's a rhetoric around monuments that we want to get this thing built before all of that generation has died off. And the reason we want it is to teach future generations about those men.
Dr. Karen Cox wrote the book on the UDC, and I asked her if it was fair to say the group established the Lost Cause as historical fact in the South.
Oh my God, yeah. They were the leaders of the Lost Cause into the 20th century, and they made it a movement about vindication.
Just to give you an idea of how effective they were, They successfully lobbied for a Confederate memorial in Arlington National Cemetery, which U.S. President Woodrow Wilson proudly unveiled to a cheering crowd. Now that's influence, right?
Monuments are the least of what they did.
What?
I mean, they are the most visible and tangible, but the work with children was far more influential.
It turns out a central UDC objective is shaping how children think about the war and their Southern heritage. One of their most powerful tools? Textbooks. Take a look at this pamphlet called A Measuring Rod for Textbooks. It was written by the illustrious Southern historian Miss Mildred Rutherford, an educator, orator, and author of Southern history textbooks. She's also very pro-slavery. The pamphlet announced the formation of a textbook review committee featuring prominent Southerners like five former Confederate generals. This group was committed to spreading the truths of Confederate history, so they instructed school boards to reject any textbooks that did not accord full justice to the South. And they urged libraries to deface every book in their collection that didn't measure up by writing the words unjust to the South clearly on its cover. This pamphlet was shared widely with school boards throughout the South, and UDC-backed committees closely monitored history books to make sure Northern influence never reached classrooms. So the core language of an approved textbook aligned precisely with that of the lost cause. You know, stuff like,
"The Confederacy lost in the war between the states, but Georgia never forgot to honor her Confederate soldiers."
History of Georgia was on the UDC's approved list. It was also written by E. Merton Coulter, a self-described Southern historian and historian-described white supremacist.
They understand that how you educate, who wins the writing game, who wins the battle over history, ultimately wins the war. That's the big fight for the UDC.
But their work with children went further than the classrooms. The UDC formed an auxiliary group called the Children of the Confederacy, which was designed to get kids born in former Confederate states to actively participate in their version of history. Group leaders had kids recite call and response truths from something called the Confederate Catechism. Children up to the age of 18 would compete and be rewarded for memorizing long passages of lost cause rhetoric.
So it would be like an after school thing, you know, like that was your club. You would go after school to the meeting of the Children of the Confederacy, and your leader might teach you songs of the South, like Dixie or other songs that were considered Southern patriotic songs. They would have them write essays, go visit the veterans, and learn this catechism.
Children were also the centerpiece of their community's monument unveilings, like this living flag at the dedication of the Stonewall Jackson Monument in Richmond. Yes, those are school children. The UDC's efforts shaped the identities of children who grew up with the lost cause. They made history personal, and that made their story last longer.
Generations of children learning that narrative in a variety of ways grow up to be, you know, segregationist in the 50s and 60s, because that's been drilled into them since they were children.
After World War I, the UDC started losing steam, but the damage was done. The monuments were in place, and the textbooks they wrote remained in Southern classrooms until the late 70s. And the women's group did it all without the right to vote or participate in politics.
You can still get glimmers of this lost cause memory of the war from people who will always choose to see it through the personal. And I think the UDC, to a great extent, was that was their goal.
So the next time someone says the Confederate monuments are about remembering our history, just know that that's exactly what the United Daughters of the Confederacy wants you to think.
That minimize the tragedy of slavery, the horrors of stealing land from indigenous people, the terrible conditions that immigrants face when they arrive to this nation, whether it's in the 18th, 19th, 20th or 21st century, and the attempt to reimagine the true experience of people who are at the bottom. And so it is incumbent for people who have been, who are at the bottom, to continue to cry out and say, here is my story. Here is the story of our people. And for those who are empowered, it is going to be uncomfortable because it's a reckoning with the reality of those who have suffered from the oppression that exists. It's a challenge, but I think that people are capable of rising to the occasion. And that is, let us see who we are as we are, and then let us, with that knowledge, create a future that is more inclusive. We can either close our eyes and cover our ears and pretend that things are a certain way and continue to go down a path of continued destruction, or we can open our eyes and unplug our ears and hear the voices and see the people and create a better future for all of us.
If you ask me, well, what should we be doing differently? I can't give you a blueprint. If I could, I would have written a better book than Faces at the Bottom of the Well. But I can say that once we adopt a different outlook with regard to the causes of racism, how we deal with it, I think then that individuals, particularly in their own areas of education or employment or whatever it is, will be able to fashion ideas that make more sense in our present world.
Professor Bell, let me ask this question. Do you think that we're black and white strong enough to face this concept of the permanence of racism? Strong enough?
I guess I don't know. My proselytizing has with it the hope that we will be. Otherwise, we are condemned to repeat a series of patterns that I can trace back for 300 years.
Well, that's our show for today. Thank you so much for listening to Let's Talk About Race. I like to end the show by saying every day and in every way, we hope you agitate for social change. Thank you for listening.
For more information on Let's Talk About Race, visit us on social media. We're on Facebook at Let's Talk Race 1, or check us out on Instagram at LTAR Show or www.letstalkrace.net.
The following program has been produced by Grassroots News Northwest.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
You are listening to KBOO FM Portland. My name is Kathy, and this is A Different Nature.